time, it's like really heartwarming to see so this many people like passionate about the subject and growth and trying to improve. And then also an obvious thank you to the panelists. I think objectively speaking, it's a really good panel. And one of the great things about the panel is that they're all very versatile. I think that they probably could have been and probably have been on panels on other topics like leadership and public policy and relationships and disabilities and stuff like that. But I think this particular topic of growth and meaningful growth and healthy growth and trying to become a better person and overcoming the obstacles that prevent you from doing that is really right up their alley. And I think that you'll see that they're perfect for this panel, not in just what they say, but how they say it and how genuine they are and how passionate they are. And it really should just be, I think it's going to be an unbelievable learning experience and growth experience. And I'd like to pass on to my co-president, Tali Schiff, who will introduce the panelists and moderate the whole event. So, thank you.
Thanks, Cuba. As you mentioned, we're the co-presidents of Active Minds, along with some other awesome board members. Stand up, you're an awesome board member.
Stand up, awesome board
member. Yeah. So Active Minds is an organization that is dedicated kind of across the country, but we are the YA chapter, dedicated to destigmatizing mental illness and stomping out the stigma, as you might know it. And I think really we felt that the first step to do so to stomping out the stigma around mental illness is really promoting awareness and understanding of mental health and our own personal mental health parameters. We thought that this time of year could really be an awesome opportunity, and we clearly have unbelievable speakers, as you mentioned. And I know Tuesday night before work, that is not the ideal time. You just have like a night to hang out with us, so we really appreciate all the passion and enthusiasm that you are showing by being here to our cause. To introduce our panelists, we have here Rabbi Yaakov Glasser, who is the Dean of YU Center for the Jewish Future, as well as the Rabbi of the Young Israel of St. Clifton. He also served as the International Director of Education for us as well. Thank you, Rabbi. Next we have Rabbi Dr. Mordechai Schiffman, who is a psychologist in YU's Counseling Center. And has also served as the assistant rabbi at Kingsway Jewish Center for the past 8 years. Thank you, Rabbi. Next, we have Dr. Stephen Glitzman, who is a professor of psychology at YC and Furkoff Graduate School of Psychology. And he also served as the renowned and beloved camp psychologist at Camp Hass. But at least we have Rabbi Josh Blass, who's a Mashgiach Rukhani here at YU, as well as the Rabbi of Kehillas Beis Yehuda in Lansing. So tonight we want to talk about, obviously, personal growth and change from both within the context of mental health and the context of religion. So really working on ourselves and our Avodas Hashem as well as in our mental health. So to kind of frame the discussion, we want to just start off with a question. How do you understand the intersection between emotional and spiritual growth? Are they connected? Are they one and the same? Are they different? And does this affect how to effectively work on them? So whoever wants to start us.
Okay, as the least mentally stable member of the panel, I will start. First of all, I just want to commend you on this amazing, incredible, unbelievable event and organization. You know, a lot's changed since I was a student at YU, although not in this particular room. Absolutely nothing has changed. But the whole notion that this is something we talk about, and that this is something we talk about openly, and this is something people will make a priority when they're very busy, in a busy time, to come together. It's such a central aspect of who we are, and of who we are as people, who we are as Jews, and it's an amazing journey that you're taking the whole year with this project, and I'm honored to be part of it, and I'm honored to be on this illustrious panel, and excited that I'm going to get about $500 of mental health, professional help for free over the course of the evening, and very honored to be with these amazing panelists. These are all incredible people, and you're very fortunate. So the question that we're looking at here is the intersection between emotional and spiritual growth. So I know everybody's going to have a lot to say, so I'm just going to make one small point, and I'll leave space for other people to interject in as well. I think the most important word in that question is the word growth. I think that very often we think about emotionality and spirituality from the disposition of stability. Sort of like, do you have it, do you not have it? Are you emotionally stable, or are you not emotionally stable? Are you emotionally, not emotionally, are you spiritually stable, or are you not spiritually stable? The most important thing to understand is that life is an evolving process of growth. And there is a distinction between one's emotional well-being, which has to do with your sense of psychological and emotional equilibrium, your sense of control over yourself, over your life, over the way in which you process your life experience in the world, and your spirituality, which refers more to your sense of transcendence and your aspiration to connect with something that's beyond yourself, something otherworldly, God, and that is both outside of you and within you. Spirituality exists in how we try to connect to things beyond us, as we imagine them beyond us. And spirituality also refers to, perhaps most practically refers to, how do we connect to a certain divine aspect within ourselves. And the two are very related. The two are very related because they both are a journey within inside ourselves. And they both relate to aspects of ourselves that are not always empirical, that are not always observable, but that are often going on inside of us, that are complex, that are nuanced, that are sometimes chaotic, and that are deeply affected not only by our physiology and certain objective elements, but are deeply affected by our upbringing, by our life, by our life experience, by our successes, by our failures, and by our journeys. So they're very affected, and one often intersects with the other. I know that for me personally, I always see emotional health as almost, I don't want to say a priority, but almost a foundation upon which to build spiritual health. If you try to build spiritual health on an unstable emotional foundation, you will often find yourself in a very unhealthy space. And very often, the spiritual journey will reveal challenges in the emotional journey. And so I think that when we're thinking about this time of year, we're thinking about our spiritual journey, and we start to introspect within ourselves and discover all sorts of complicated feelings and goals and barriers and things that we're trying to accomplish, and we encounter challenges in our emotional health, I think that it is absolutely foundational to address those at the foundation of everything. I think it's, I once heard, I don't remember from which YU personality, that we believe in sanity before sanity. Very important, and that's important, and that's fundamental. And sometimes we'll even compromise on spiritual goals in deference to working on emotional goals. And that is a long-term good decision. And that sometimes is where rabbis and psychologists work together, because we think that we have to hit those spiritual goals no matter what. And sometimes we take a backseat to spiritual goals to address our emotional goals.
You're supposed to go in order or not, but first I want to echo what Greg Glasser said. Hey, this is an amazing panel, and also just the enormous feeling of pride. I know most of the guys here and the girls. It just this organization, the openness towards growth. I'm so excited to come back to Yeshiva last week. Just because to be back in the base medrash, back in my office, and guys flew over to really speak and be open and willing to be vulnerable, and such a beautiful energy to be around, and just very proud of you and many others like you. I just want to be proud of Akiva and the Yitzi and some of the others who spent so many hours putting together this organization, of course, as well. I just want to maybe piggyback on what Greg Glasser said just very briefly. Glasser said that often the foundation of spiritual health is emotional health, and that's certainly borne out in psychology, it's more now even in halacha about the sort of the necessity of psychological health, even being able to be halal Shabbos for psychological health, and sort of seeing the sort of the absolute importance of it. There's also sort of one other piece just want to mention briefly, and that is that spirituality, connecting with God, is really feeling the presence of God in a person's life. The gentle presence of God in one's life. You know, not sort of the scary presence, not the punitive presence, but just the feel of a God awareness and a God consciousness in a very healthy way. And that feeling is almost impossible if our entire being, our entire entity, everything about us is overridden and defined by and completely clogged with so many things in our life emotionally that are not healthy. And it's very hard to feel the gentle presence of God in one's life, God awareness, God consciousness, if a person is feeling depressed, if a person is feeling absolutely resentful towards anyone and everyone, if a person is feeling fears and anxieties, if a person is feeling trauma in their life, they haven't recovered from childhood. So then where can sort of God lie in a person's consciousness if the entire sort of essence of the person, emotionally and psychologically, is defined by so many things that perhaps might be toxic or unhealthy in the person? And it's just almost impossible. It's like trying to bring in a new shipment of drinks at 7-Eleven and the whole freezer is filled with the drinks that are there already. I mean, where is God going to fit in our lives if we're carrying around with us sort of so much stuff? And I think once that happens, once we sort of release a lot of that, work through a lot of that, get the help that we need for so many of those things, deal with so many issues, that we can sort of begin to feel like a very healthy, gentle presence of God in one's life. But until that happens, our search for God will often be through the prism of our own unhealthiness, our own needs, our own insecurities, our own imbalance, our own sort of radical nature. And sort of clearing all that out allows a very healthy way for God to come into there and just sort of follow the look.
So, also thank you for having me and thank you for having this. I also want to start by just pointing out that in the panel, you know, we have shared experiences, we have different experiences, we're all products of our education. There are things that we might say that overlap each other, things that contradict each other, and it'll all be true. Will be good. And what that means is that if a certain derech, a certain approach speaks to you, so then that's the one you can run with. And if a given one speaks to you, then that's the one you run with. I'll also say that I'm sometimes going to be glancing over at the rabbi doctor's, that's because he has a question. So with that in mind, I don't see actually a connection between emotional and spiritual growth. And the reason for that, and we're all products of our education. I'm a developmental psychologist, so we'll have a clinical approach to this. But let me ask you, how would you feel if somebody's running towards you with a knife? So how does that mean, how would you feel? Like, what emotion would you have?
Scared?
Yeah? Anything else?
Fear.
Panic? Yeah. All right. What's the real answer? It depends. Right? If you're in a dark alley and it's a stranger running towards you with a knife, yeah, I would also feel scared. If I'm on a fishing dock and my father is running towards me with a knife, I might say, well, thank you for the knife. Right now I can go fish. Right? And I'm really not gonna.
Depends on your father,
maybe. Right? To be fair, if I saw my father in a dark alley running towards me with a knife, I would be scared.
Very free.
But what I'm pointing out though is that a lot of times, the emotion you're feeling, some would argue all the time, even though it's in a nanosecond, even though it's sometimes, even though it's a split second, even though you don't recognize it, but the emotions you feel are based on your interpretations of what's going on around you. So when we talk about emotional growth and spiritual growth, I think that a big foundation of both of those growths is how you're interpreting yourself, how you're interpreting your situation, how you're interpreting Hashem. And it has nothing to do with intelligence. It has nothing to do with how smart you are. I work,
a lot with people with intellectual disabilities, kind of as I said, some of whom are extraordinarily spiritual, even if they have a very concrete view of Hashem, even if they view Hashem as, you know, a man with a long beard up in the sky. That doesn't take away from their spirituality at all. So it's not about intelligence, right? It's not about the smarts, right? But there is this idea of sometimes the emotions we feel are very much grounded in how we think about ourselves, and how we think about the world, and how we think about our behavior, and how we think about our circumstances. And it's the rational part of our mind, I think, that sometimes you need to get a hold of in order to bring about that emotional security, that emotional growth, that spiritual growth we're looking for. So it's a different approach. You like it, that's good. But I think that if we take a step back and really ask ourselves, where do I see myself? How do I see myself? Like, why do I see myself the way I do? And look at it from that kind of like interpretive perspective. So you might find that things that are getting in the way of our emotional growth and our spiritual growth will sometimes be a lot easier to deal with.
Okay, so echoing the remarks about being on this panel, so I'm looking to which direction of man. These are my own mentors when I was in TAS and then did research with them my first year in NYU back in 2006 with the last of my scholarship. And my last year was my rabbinic mentor. And I'm a little bit in awe here. But I do have something that I think is slightly different than the approaches that have been said until now. And just reflecting on the question one more time, is the connection between emotional and spiritual growth. So I think that there is definitely a connection. So disagree over here, but
the student has surpassed the master.
on three different, we can look at it from three different perspectives. And the first perspective, I think, is on an inherent level. So when we talk about emotional growth, so just to also distinguish between regular daily emotions that all of us experience are going to be different than, it's a different discussion than a mental health or mental illness issue per se. So we all experience anxiety, we all experience anger, we all experience sadness to some extent. So those are emotions that we all deal with and that for sure will affect our spirituality, will affect our relationship with Hashem. So on an inherent level, the Rambam says that we have to do tshuva for deos, for midos, for character, for which includes kas, anger, gaiva. All of our emotions are related to tshuva. We need to do tshuva for emotional experiences that get us further away from God and further away from our fellow being. So that's on an inherent level. It really is a connection between emotions and the spiritual level. And then the second level is on a qualitative level. So if you think about any mitzvah that we do, so we can do a mitzvah without any real thought, without any real emotion, we're just doing it by rote. Or we can do a mitzvah with our full concentration, with the mindfulness, with all of our emotional experiences that come that we experience on a Hasidic level or on a Musar level, to be tamim with Hashem and to really bring that whole emotional energy, the lishma of a mitzvah, really change on the qualitative level every single interaction that we have with God or with others. And then finally, on a functional level, I think this is really important. Somebody who has an emotional awareness of how to deal with their own anxiety. So they are anxious about a test, they're anxious about a relationship, and then they're going to morning seder, or they're going to learn Torah, or daven. So how are you going to daven when you're ruminating over and over and over and over again about the anxious experience that you just had, or you're angry at your roommate for whatever they did last night? How are you going to daven ma'ariv then? How are you going to even study for your schoolwork? So our emotions affect everything that we do. So just on a functional level, even if it's not an actual inherent in the mitzvah, but it's going to affect every single possible interaction we have with God and with other people. So there's no question in my mind that we have to focus on our emotional experiences, because without them, without having the emotional intelligence and the awareness and the control and the management of those emotions, we're not going to be able to do any mitzvah as well as we probably could or should.
We can take one question.
Sure. I would to go to my one.
Do you have an example of being, you said there was like our interpretive, like how we interpret ourselves, and then maybe it plays out into our spiritual and our emotional life? I was wondering. Because to me it sounded like you were describing our emotional life and you know, how we see ourselves and how we manage ourselves. That just sounded to me like our emotional health. Can you give an example of how they're separate?
So for example, if the reason, if you feel that because you've committed some sort of sin over the year that you're a bad person, so that's an interpretation, right? That's like a view, right? That's that's you interpreting your behavior in a way that goes to the core of your personality. That's probably not true. You're probably a good person, right? You know, sometimes I write books in my head, right? Never written one on paper, but sometimes it's when I'm walking down the street, I'll write books. I thought yesterday I'd write a book called Lies I Told My Dog, right? So one of the lies I told my dog is that just because he chewed up the pillow, that makes him a bad dog, right? It's not a bad dog, right? Because that's what I say, a bad dog, right? What do you think? It's not a bad dog. You did a bad thing. It's not a bad dog. So we say that about ourselves, too. Like, the reason I can't, achieve my spiritual growth, the reason I can't reach the level that I want to, the reason I don't learn enough, the reason that I don't, or the reason I just not do things, the reason I do things, right? The reason I keep succumbing to this, right? The reason I keep doing this behavior, the reason I keep doing things that, parents or teachers or therapists or whoever didn't say, it's because I'm weak or I can't do it. But that doesn't have to be the case. In this approach, dialectical behavior therapy, right? Dialectics means that two opposite things can both be true, right? So even though he disagrees, he's right. The two opposite things can both be true, right? So, we all have our rational minds, right? And we all have our emotional minds. And the key is to keep them in balance. And how do you do that? So you do that by when you realize you're being overly emotional. The reason when you realize that your emotions are sort of getting the best of you. That's the when you have to stop and say, wait, I need to think this through. And also, if your rational side is overbearing, is overpowering, right? So that means you're not focusing on your emotions. You're not focusing on other people's emotions, right? If you're just logical, right? So then you might not be recognizing that how another person feels or how you yourself feel. So that idea of, when you find your emotions taking over, when you find the balance tipping, right? I'm a bad person because, right? So then say, wait a minute. Is that true? Like, is it true? Like, let's verify. I'm a really bad person. Like, yes, I did this. But like, let's think about the things I did. I also did some good things today. Also, apparently, people like me. Also, apparently, lots of things that are good about me. So when we talk about, sort of keeping that balance, right? It's specifically when you find your emotions taking over, that's when your rational mind comes in. And specifically when your rational mind is taking over, that's when your emotions should come in. And that's how you keep that balance. That's how you stay alive.
Okay, next question. So I think one of the areas that people, or one of the reasons people might think that this time of year specifically, sometimes there is more of a clash than at other times between mental health and HM, are maybe some of the intense feelings that it seems that halacha, or at least hashkafa, seems to demand of us at this time of year. So how do you think one can feel the regret necessary to do tshuva without falling into an unproductive cycle of guilt? So, and a little bit of a separate question, so you can choose one or combine the two. Where is the line between humility and low self-esteem? Start with Heather.
So, I will take the first part of the question, and humility and self-esteem, to a different time. Always do it in the panel. So the question is, how do I balance tshuva, the demands that are imposed? imposed upon us, perhaps, by Hashkafa and Halacha, with keeping that healthy. So I think the answer to the question is to actually disagree with the question itself. So inherent in your question is that there's a demand on Halacha to do something. There's a demand on us that's imposed, that's weighing down upon us. And I think that when it comes to our emotional health and the anxiety, the unhealthy guilt that could come along, or the depression that could come along with feeling overburdened by the tshuva process, is because we look at it in terms of demands. And just to give you a 2-minute background into this concept, there's a psychologist by the name of Albert Ellis who developed rational motive behavior therapy. I'm trained in RBT. This is really what I practice most of the time in therapy. Most of the time comes down to demands. What are demands? Demands are when we think to ourselves that I have to, I must, there's no choice. I'm stuck, and there's absolutely no way to get around something. So I put demands either on myself or other people to accomplish something, to do something, to behave in a certain way. And if I have a demand, it's called an irrational belief, if I have this demand, I'm probably going to lead myself into emotional trouble. Because if I don't live up to this demand, if I don't follow through, I'm going to feel unhealthily, insert your emotion here, anxious, angry, depressed, guilty. Because when I think in terms of demands and I don't follow through, I'm stuck. On the one hand, A, I have to do something, and B, I didn't. So if it's an absolute that has to, and then it's not, I put myself in this realm where my brain can't really analyze that. I'm stuck. So I have to, but I didn't. I have to change, I didn't change. I can't do that sin, but I did do that sin. So I get stuck. So what do I do about that? The one thing to know, if I'm actually in a healthy emotion or an unhealthy emotion, is am I reaching my goal? I have a goal. I want to do tshuva. I want to change. If I'm not going towards that goal of change, then that proves that the emotion that I'm feeling right now is probably unhealthy, maladaptive. But if the emotion that I'm feeling could be a negative emotion, I could feel sad, I could feel regret, I could feel guilt that I did something wrong, but I'm working to change that, then that's probably a proof that I'm in a healthy realm. So how do I deal with this if I'm in an unhealthy realm and I'm stuck and I feel unhealthily anxious, guilty, etc., because I have this type of demand that I have to act in a certain way, but I'm not. So what's the alternative to that? To give up? I don't have to do tshuva? I don't have to change? So the answer is, the way we talk to ourselves is really important. If instead of saying, I have to change, we say to ourselves, I want to change. I prefer to change. I value change. It's my goal to change. Then all of a sudden, I'm working from, if you want to frame it in this way, an Abba Sadat perspective. I'm doing this. I'm motivated out of, this is what I wanted. This is my goal. This is my value. Versus the more, I have to, I need to, I must, and then I get stuck because I'm not. And then I give up hope because I'm just, again, stuck. So if we think in terms of, I want to, I prefer, it's my goal, we have a better shot at not getting weighed down in the unhealthy guilt. And healthy guilt is great. Feel bad about the bad stuff that you've done. That's what we all should be doing around tshuva. Tshuva is not bad. Guilt isn't bad. It could become unhealthy if we think about it and approach it in the wrong perspective. I have follow-ups, but I'll leave some space for others.
I think we'll take one or two more on this question.
I think I really just want to say the same thing very, very Schiffman said, Dr. Schiffman said, but, you know, again, there's really nothing wrong with a sense of regret. When a person stops regretting behavior, that's, to me, that's very unhealthy. You know, that some degree of sense of regret, regret means that I have certain expectations, ambitions, dreams for myself, but then that often can cross the line to something that feels very, very, unhealthy. Shame and guilt, some other person is carrying along with them. And I think the way, at least for me, of what I see from people, of keeping those feelings of regret in a very healthy place, is just the ability to talk about them and to talk with someone about them. Because if you don't sort of have someone to speak about, and you've done X, Y, and Z, you can fill the blank, just sits on us, it drags the energy of our life down. We end up needing to medicate that guilt by running off to do something else. We're not functional, we beat ourselves up. Just want to say, you know, this is what I'm feeling, and let me sort of talk out with a friend or a rebbe or a mentor, just be able to sort of like normalize those feelings a little bit. And where do I go with that as sort of the redemption of these things? Just again, that not crossing the line from regret to something that feels like it's taking over and defining and dragging a person down and making the person isolate and making the person then sort of act out even more. And that line is there. The way that often I go to deal with that again is by being in touch with people and talking about those feelings. I'd also say just on a different note, I don't talk too long. I think for me, a spiritual approach for these things is often helpful. I can beat myself up for doing X, Y, and Z, and I spent a lot of years doing that, and how come I keep on doing the same thing over and over again, and how come this, and how come that, and how come there's all sorts of things that we tell ourselves about ourselves. By the way, if you think that only 22-year-olds tell themselves, oh, I'm the biggest loser. No. Everyone, at different points in their life, like, can beat themselves up. And then, to some degree, you never want to get rid of a feeling of regret, but to also say, you know what, I'm just going to sort of accept myself a little bit and accept the fact that this is exactly the place that the Shtarpel has put me in, and it's not coming as a punishment, and it's not, and just to sort of be able to accept a little bit, okay, this is the challenge. This is the challenge that God has given me. This is the way that God created me. And I'm going to be able to sort of embrace that. Where do I now go from here? That's a very different attitude and energy than just like, woe is me, I'm a loser, I beat myself up, my life is garbage. You know, like, okay, this is what God's putting me in, and how do I now grow from here? And in every single situation in life, that attitude of acceptance, and where do I now go from here, and that positive energy, it literally makes all the difference in the world. And everything. You know, in marriage and raising children and going by ourselves and say, oh, okay, fine. And now what? And then now where do I go from there?
Yes.
I want to just build on what my last said by connecting the first and the second part of the question. I always find personally, and I also look at our class as saying, I also believe it. I also feel like a loser.
My everybody feels like they're inadequate. But just for the record, I felt that when we were introducing the panel.
So I just want to build on something you said because I think it's important. So when I think about Saka, I find this to be challenging. Regret falling into an unproductive cycle of guilt. You regret what you've done, you want to change, and you're stuck in this abyss of, like, it's never going to happen. And that's where the question of humility versus self-esteem comes in. I think that we often focus on the problems a lot more than we celebrate what's good about us. And if you're going to go through a process of tshuva, or a process of change, and all you're going to focus on is what's wrong, then I think this experience is almost inevitable. Because all of us can inventory everything that's wrong with us and look at that list and just collapse in being overwhelmed. The question is, I think this gets to what Dr. Kurtzman said before, if alongside that list is everything that's right with us, if we have a healthy sense of self, of what we can be and who we are, and how much positive energy exists within us, and how much we've accomplished, and we celebrate those accomplishments, and that's part of the larger landscape that includes looking at the regrets of things that could be better, then the holistic experience is entirely different. And I think that our tradition understands this. I don't think that Elul and Aseres Yimei Tshuva asks of us to only focus on what's wrong. I think it's one of the very mystifying aspects of Rosh Hashanah, which sort of disrupts this whole process by not focusing on what's wrong at all, and focusing on our role as the Jewish people, and being Mamlech Hashem, and all these wonderful aspects of us. I think that aside from thinking about all of the challenges that we face, and I think in terms of humility and self-esteem, humility means I know who I am,
I know my strengths and weaknesses. I just don't flaunt them. And also, I think most importantly, I'm always willing to learn and to grow with them. I don't have this sense that I'm done. I find that humble people are always looking for other people so that they can grow. Not that they can be knocked down, that they can grow. Healthy, an unhealthy self-esteem is not understanding what you're worth, is not understanding your value, is not understanding your potential. So when we look at tshuva and we look at regret, I think it's a healthy thing to regret certain behavior in the context of appreciating, number one, how much behavior is great, number two, how much potential we have in this growth to conquer this behavior, and I think this is an incredibly important point, and that it doesn't have to all happen tomorrow. And I think a lot of where regret spirals into paralyzing guilt is in the feeling that this all has to be fixed by next Sunday night. And if it isn't, then we're going to be judged and we're all going to hell. Or to say, wherever we're going, I live to say. Right? You know, look, it's not in the judgment day, sort of evokes this image. It's not a question exclusively of where you are at a particular moment. It's a question of trajectory. It's a question of, that's what growth is. Growth means that we're on a path, that we're, it doesn't all get fixed at once, and we have to appreciate the incremental steps. We have to know that sometimes it's two steps forward and one step backwards, and that's normal. And then the sense of regret isn't paralyzing, because it's part of the process of moving forward, and that process is largely an encouraging, empowering process, not just a, sense of, oh my God, what did I do wrong, and how am I going to get myself back?
No, nobody that I heard on the panel has said don't feel what you're feeling. Everybody has said add to that the positives. And I think the reason for that is because you can't argue with an emotion. Like, emotions just are. You can't fight it. If somebody says, don't feel bad, like, it doesn't mean it's meaningless. Because, like, if you feel bad, you feel bad. You can't argue with that. Right? So when it comes to, another thing about emotions is that if you do try to fight an emotion, emotions are like muscles, right? If you push against it, there's a very good chance that it's going to get strong. So when you look at those, negative feelings that you have about you, the idea isn't to say, I shouldn't feel guilty, I shouldn't feel regret, I shouldn't feel... You feel how you feel. But keep in mind that feelings are just feelings, and thoughts are just thoughts. And they don't have to order you around. They don't have to become your boss. I feel guilty about things. And I also feel hopeful about things. I feel bad for some things that I've done, and I also feel very nice for some things that I've done. But don't deny your emotions. And don't think that if you have a feeling that's getting you down, and it's getting in the way of your growth, you're gonna... So to try to just ignore it and push it to the side, there's a very good chance it's gonna do whatever it can to get back in the center. Accept that that's how you feel. Look at yourself as a whole, right? And recognize that it's not about denying. It's not about denying how you feel. Because remember, the feelings are just feelings. This is not my line, so I can repeat it. Feelings are just feelings. Thoughts are just thoughts. They don't have to control you.
Next question is, how do you recommend approaching habits or behaviors or traits that we try year after year to change without success?
Just before I comment on that, this is something obviously that is probably one of how you wrote the questions. Thanks, Nadia. I appreciate it. I think that's a real, real difficult and we all grapple with, and obviously what should be asked, but they're so thoughtful and so well viewed. But as I mentioned just before anything else, that all four of us are here, I don't know if we can say afterwards, but certainly like the things that are being mentioned and discussed, spoken of briefly, but really open up into an ocean of who we are, and all of us are available. Don't know who we are personally, you can find our information online, but these are really conversations that should go on beyond sort of the hour and a half that we have. And obviously this issue is so complicated, you know, dealing with the same habits, you know, for 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 years, some of which might be small and not so meaningful, and some of which are enormously painful and create just all the feelings to have before, you know, guilt and regret, etc. But I would just say two things. The first is very, very much emphasize what Ellie Glasser said. You know, chances are, let me just sort of speak plainly, but let's say someone is demonstrating compulsive behavior over and over again. Chances are that in a lot of cases, people made progress over the course of the last year or 2 years or 5 years or 10 years, and to allow ourselves to see that, not to say, oh, you know, garbage, and I've not completely whipped this habit or whipped this behavior, and say, you know what, I have my whole life ahead of me, it's a slow journey, and that sort of positivity and sort of emotional self-care is very important. But the second piece also is maybe really analyzing and assessing sort of the habit. And I would say from two different ends of it. The first is just in a very, very practical way. I never read this great book called The Power of Habit, that was called. It came out last year. What's that? I never read this book. So good. That's her story in Egypt about this lady. It's basically this lady who changed her entire life by committing herself to running herself, like running through the desert by the pyramids in Egypt. And she did it not. She walked it or whatever it is. So her commitment of doing sort of this one thing, which sort of seems like, you know, whatever it was, like it made her start to exercise, it made her stop to smoke, it made her start to dress better. Small things can often change our lives. And instead of saying, I need to stop doing X, right? Person would say, well, what are the couple good healthy actions that I can do to sort of get myself into a healthier place? What are sort of small things I can do? What are like a few small actions that are very much yodi that I could do that starts making changes in my life? And I think that's really important. Not to try to tackle something, you know, and then look at it as all or nothing, but really sort of look at smaller pieces of who we are and smaller actions. And then the second piece of that is maybe looking almost behind the scenes of certain habits or behaviors. And sometimes it's really helpful. If a person has a certain type of habit, maybe it's because they're already in the category of being an addict in certain types of ways. Instead of beating ourselves up, we were doing X, Y, and Z. Maybe say, you know what, I need to sort of look, you know, behind the scene, and maybe I need a certain type of help because I am having addictive behavior. Maybe there's a lot of unresolved things in my mind. Maybe I'm feeling enormous insecurities and that are leading me to X, Y, and Z. So let me tackle sort of the scenery behind. Let me deal with the tapestry of my life that might be leading me towards habits instead of just sort of focusing on that final tip of behavior. But there's a whole, again, there's a whole tapestry of our lives that sometimes really need to be examined that can then help affect sort of the specific habitual behavior that's coming out of that. So A, again, specific sort of behaviors that we can try to change, and also to look at the entire landscape behind that, and hopefully by continuing over the course of life to work on that, that can help change the behavior as well.
I think that's
really
helpful. In terms of, you know, some of the, you know, spiritual growth obstacles that we seem to be doing chuva for year after year after year, it strikes me that to some degree, it's almost expected that we're going to fall into these traps and we're going to do things that we regret. How do I know it's expected?
Repeat every year.
Huh?
Repeat comes every year.
Yeah, and they're printed in the monster. Like they're codified that I'm going to do chuba for not speaking to my parents appropriately. Like for speaking Lashonara, for having impure thoughts. Like it's all there, like it's spelled out. Like somebody put that in print, you know? It doesn't say, you know, I'll paint, fill in the blank here for your, like, it's known that I'm gonna do these things. So I try not to. But the idea that sometimes, you know, we can really recognize that it's not easy. These things aren't easy, you know, breaking habits or, but all these things that we're trying to achieve, the reason that we're struggling is because they're not easy to do. And just because people aren't in this room doesn't mean that they're also not struggling, you know? Because everybody gets the same mindset. But everybody has that list, and everybody's supposed to say, this is what comes up, this has been put into the process. So when it comes to how to deal with tapping, so there is there is that practical for people have to bring habits, but to also recognize that the reason that this occurs every year is because it's not easy. And that itself
I want to just, first of all, everything is very inspiring, and I agree with it. I want to add one other point, and that is that I question whether or not we shouldn't attribute, we live in a very results-oriented society, and we think the only measure of success is what the ultimate outcome and results are. And tshuva is a process. And the mitzvah is to engage in a process. And I'm not sure that I accept the assumption, one of the assumptions in the question, that just because, and I agree with what Dr. Lipton's saying, but I was supposed to do this. Because I think that even going through the process every year, even about the same thing, obviously the ultimate goal is to conquer this objective. There's no question. But it's not true that going through the process and not conquering the objective was a worthless experience. That's not true. There is value to striving for growth. There is value to striving for religious objectives. And I think relating to what was pointed out about the Matzer is that we're not the ones that set the measurement, the metrics here. It's God. And God is an understanding God, and even if we're not always hitting the exact outcome that we're looking for, being involved in that process is important. There are other dynamics that are going on when you choose to take it on that are inherently valuable, independent of whether or not you actually end up conquering what you're trying to conquer. There's a lot of introspection that goes on. There's a lot of thoughtful development of what your values are and why these things are important. There's impact that just trying to grow has on the dynamics of your religious observance and your religious life and your spiritual life. Even if this particular goal is not one that we were successful at, walking into the larger enterprise of personal growth and personal change and spiritual growth, I think in and of itself has an inherent value. And I believe me, live with the frustration. And by the way, your life, there'll be years where it's not always things that just, no matter what you do, you can't get them. Sometimes you will get them, and then the next year you'll lose them. Or you'll get them, and then you'll lose them twice. Then you'll get them three times. And it's amazing. You get to certain points in your life where you're like, wow, I got this. I got it, I'm in. I got it, I'm motivated, I'm inspired, I'm in. I can't ever imagine losing it. And then all of a sudden, 6 months, you're right back where you were. That's not failure. That never happened. Those 6 months were very precious, and were very real, and count, and matter. And matter not just for those 6 months, they matter for the rest of your life. This is life. Life is a lot of ups and downs, and a lot of forward and backwards, and figuring things out. The other thing I want to say about habits that we're trying to kick is that all of our religious behavior takes place in a context. And even if sometimes you're looking at the behavior the same way every year, the context within which you're living your life often changes. What's your spiritual environment? Where are your priorities? Where's your time? What are the pressures that are on you? What are you struggling with? What's going on at home? What's going on in your other relationships? And when the context changes, very often, the strategy has to change in terms of how to address the habit, or very often just the reality of whether or not that particular habit is even the priority anymore has to be reassessed. So it's a very personalized
experience, but, you know, and I think some things are like Lashon Hara. Lashon Hara is something that, you know, it's like out there, like, we should all not speak Lashon Hara. We know we're all gonna, so it's something we're going to work on, and can we ever really do it, you know, can we ever, then there are very personal things, like particular aspects of Lashon Hara, or certain relationship facets, or certain B'nadam Atzmo, you know, facets that are very hard, and they're hard differently next year than they were last year. So I think we have to often look at our larger context and sort of evaluate and get a sense of self-assess what to do, how to do, and what to work on, sometimes based on a larger picture, not just a behavioral, we gotta change, we gotta modify this thing.
Thanks. So now as Larry Glass was said, not to take away from Dr. Shiffman, but
well,
just mention, I just want to tell you, I had a Tom, a guy from Yeshiva, was in my office last week, and he was just like crying, like literally, like nothing but an entire box of tissues. You know, you think only girls cry, but it's not the. And if you get someone the right time, the right place, you know, anybody, just crying about a certain behavior. Change and sort of pressed it out and is working at it and some of the years and about to finish up and like, oh. And after about 20 minutes of like, you know, the snorting and crying, he's like, so Rabbi, what do you say about this? I said, well, I don't be insensitive, but this is a really, if you step back for a second, it's like a really beautiful scene. The very fact that you care so much about this and that you're really trying, as Ray Glass was like, you're engaging in it, and you're not giving up, and this is important to you, like you guys, what it says about you as a person. You guys, what this says about just your future and dealing with things and just who you are and the way that Peshwar wants to even like view this person sitting here. And again, it's always sort of like a different way of looking at sort of those same experiences. And I think we sort of owe that to ourselves instead of often become like sort of so dejected and sort of kind of destructive. But anyway, so that's your point.
So I agree with everything so far, no disagreements here. I just want to give a little bit of a spin. We spoke about habits. So if anybody wants to Google later, just to give you a resource, there's something that in the literature is called SMART goals. It's really the go-to concept when you're trying to change habits. SMART goals means the goal should be specific, measurable, achievable, achievable and both realistic. That's it. Achievable, realistic, and time-bound. So basically, when we go into Elul and we say, I want to be a better person, that goal sticks, right? That's not a smart that goal theory, but in terms of being, it's not a smart goal. It's not specific, it's not measurable, it's not time-bound. Me saying, I want to daven with a minion for the next 7 days is specific, it's measurable, it's time-bound. So smart goals is just a way to keep, as Rabbi Glass said, the goals small, specific, make small changes, build momentum from that. The other thing that I wanted to reflect on is in the literature of change, there's something called the stages of change, the trans-theoretical model, where it's basically five stages of change. We start, and the names of the stages are evidence from what the title is. Pre-contemplation means I'm not thinking yet about changing. Usually there's a whole bunch of things that are just not even on our mind, not even on our radar that we're gonna change. It's just something that we accept or even know that we're doing wrong. Then contemplation is the time when we're thinking about something. We're thinking about changing, but we're not ready to make that move to change yet. And I think the next stage is where we mess up the most when it comes to tshuva during this time period, and that's the preparation stage. Do we actually prepare when it comes to change? Do we, as was said before, analyze the behavior in its context? Do we analyze the environment? Do we analyze the thoughts, the emotions? Every year how it's a little bit different. Do we think about how we're going to then go and make that change? No, we just say, I'm changing. Right? So that preparation stage, when we're planning and we're analyzing and we're asking others to help us try to have that awareness of who we are and how we can change this behavior and what's getting away and getting in the way and what childhood experiences and what personality characteristics, etc., are getting in the way of me changing. That preparation stage is usually skipped, and we go straight from pre-contemplation, I heard a nice drasha, now I'm contemplating, and now I'm action, I'm ready to go. It's already, you know, some gedalia, I'm ready to make all these changes. And since we skip preparation and we don't actually know how to change, so we revert back and then we give up. So preparation is a huge piece to CHUPA. Analyzing what we're trying to change, keeping it smart and specific is really important. And then the last part that I don't think was mentioned yet fully, that I think is really important, is analyzing the environment. I just want to spend a moment on that. So when it comes to Perkei Avos, we say both in the beginning of the second chapter and third chapter, the same basic statement, one from Yehuda Hanasi, one from Akavi ben Mahalalel, that if you're Histaka b'Shosha Dvarim, you're not going to come Lidei Avera. Let's look at three things you're not going to come to the hands of sin. And they each say different three things. But the question that the Mepharshim deal with is, what is Lidei Avera? Why don't you just say, you're not going to come to sin? La Avera. So what are we adding by saying Lidei, the hands of sin? And if you look at some of the commentators, this is the way I read them, and I might be reading too much into them, is that Lidei Avera is not the sin itself. It's the hand, the handle to the sin. It's the context. It's the environment of the sin. So if I'm trying to change, let's just go with a sort of a neutral change habit that a lot of us try to change, I want to eat healthier. So if I'm trying to eat healthy, and all I'm doing is I'm saying to myself, I'm going to eat healthy tonight. I'm not going to eat that chocolate bar at 11 o'clock at night. And then I go to my dorm room, and it's 11 o'clock at night, and I'm tired, I'm exhausted, I'm stressed out, and I have a test tomorrow. And guess what? There's a chocolate bar right there in my dorm room. What am I going to end up doing? I'm going to eat the chocolate bar, and then I'm going to beat myself up for the fact that, why can't I have that? I wake up in the morning, why can't I have the self-control and not eat that chocolate bar? And then we get stuck in that cycle. And if we're going to try to have a battle of willpower, where I'm going to have that chocolate bar there at 11 o'clock, and I'm going to say, tonight I'm not going to eat that chocolate bar, we're going to keep losing that battle over and over and over and over again. The Lidei Avera is not having the chocolate bar in your room. The Lidei Avera is setting up the environment that we're not, if we're just going to try to do a battle of will with our Yetzer Hara, there's a decent chance we're going to keep losing that battle. If we change the environmental factors, the context, the things that we do, our routines, then we have a better chance at trying to accomplish the goals that we're trying to set up.
Okay, so the hour's getting late, Anderson. If anybody has to go for shuttles or nights or whatever, but we'll wrap up with one final question, I think. So obviously, if we could bottle and package change, as Arlo last mentioned, in one-hour panel, that would be awesome, but we can't. But just for kicks, we're wondering if you could try. Is there one strategy or mantra or tip about change or growth or just approaching this time period in general that you could share with us in three sentences or less, but like proverbially you could be able to implement it, but
sentences or less from over the ground. I can't say my name. I think that everyone should realize that changing is one of the hardest things in the world to do. And when you do it, it's one of the most exhilarating and wonderful and greatest things. I think that it's important to take small steps, and to celebrate small victories, and to recognize your potential, and to recognize how great you are, and to have incredible mentors, and surround yourself with great friends.